We have loved coming to this conference now for all these years, and I can't imagine a year without it now. It's been probably 30 years that I've been coming up here to conferences. Mrs. Schaefer and I did a music conference together, a couple of music conferences together. Is that suddenly acting silly? What's going on? There we go. And I think that was 1990 or 1991, something like that. So it's been a very long, long time. We always have gremlins in the tech. There's something about the technology. Everything's plugged in properly and working beautifully, but it seems to conk out and go back off. What is that all about? Ah, I don't know. Well, I have to say on the front end, I don't have a fancy PowerPoint presentation like so many of my colleagues do. So if it doesn't work, it doesn't make any difference. I'm just going to turn it off anyway. So fear not. Who am I? And I want to add to that question, where did I come from and where am I going? I think those three questions together, who am I, where did I come from, and where am I going, make it possible to answer the question of the question that plagues us probably more than anything else today, which is, what should I be doing? Or how shall we then live? In other words, it's the question of identity once settled that will set the direction for ethics in our present culture. Now, since the question of what I should be doing implies the good, that is, it's an ethical question. Oughtness is in it, you see, and so it's an ethical question. It's where we separate into various camps, political parties, tribes. What is the good, after all? How do we define the good, after all? I saw a canvas shopping bag for sale the other day that said in big block letters, "I'm a better person than you are because I use this bag." Now, we could debate whether or not plastic shopping bags are bad for the environment, but what I don't think we should have to debate is whether or not pride and judgmental virtue signaling are bad for the environment. I think as a general rule, if we find ourselves saying, "I thank thee, O God, that I'm not like other men," "I would never shop with a bag like that," then we are in, I guess, dangerous spiritual waters. But this virtue signaling doesn't happen just because we are rotten people. In fact, it happens partly because we think we're not rotten people. And I'm going to get into that in a few minutes. But it's always been this way. Every human culture has given its answers to these questions. And while they may answer the questions differently, all cultures have agreed on one indisputable thing: that the way things are and the way things ought to be are not the same. Everybody agrees that that's how it is. There's a gap between these two, and the way things are need to be changed so that they can be more like the way things ought to be. To help with this definition, cultures down through the ages have crafted their definitions and then created art that both reflects their answers to those questions and proclaims them to the next generations, and it defines a culture. In many ways, a culture is the accumulation of those artifacts that represent the identity of the people who made them. Take the ancient Greeks, for example. There were two stories that the ancient Greeks held in very high esteem, the Iliad and the Odyssey. Why should these adventure stories become so important to the Hellenic period hundreds and hundreds of years later? Because they were more than stories for the diversion of their heroes. They were their hearers. They were a compendia. They were a way to hold within them what the culture most admired. They embodied the differences between a civilized man and a barbarian. By the way, you know, a barbarian for the Greeks was just somebody who didn't speak Greek. Did you know that? The Greeks would say, when someone comes along and doesn't speak Greek and they speak in their own native tongue, all we hear is bar, 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 bar. And so they called them barbarians. That's where that comes from. What you have here is, there you go, a frieze sculpture. I hope you can see that. It's a frieze. A frieze is a sculpture that is a relief sculpture. And it's a frieze called the Apotheosis of Homer. It was carved in the 3rd century BC, and you can see it in the British Museum. If you go to London, this is on the wall there. It depicts Homer seated in the lower left-hand corner here, with the king and queen behind him, standing in honor of him. At his feet are 2 children, symbolizing the Iliad and the Odyssey. And above him, and then there's a whole line of people going off to the right on that lowest level, people coming to bring gifts and sacrifices and so on. The apotheosis, of course, means the sort of deification of someone. It means, apo means from, and theosis, of course, is God. So it's sort of bringing somebody to the position of being God. It's a wonderful word. I'm sort of an amateur etymologist. I like the way words work and where they come from, And I've always thought it was interesting. In reading the Odyssey, you come across Odysseus the first time on the island of Calypso. Do you know the story? Everybody know the story? Yeah. On the island of Calypso. Well, the name Calypso means hidden. And that's what he is. You see, he's hidden away from the world. And he's longing to get back to Penelope and back to the world again. He's going to work his way back home again. But for the moment, he's hidden away, you see, with hidden. Calypso. And that's why the Greek word for the last book in the Bible is apocalypso, the apocalypse, you see, because it's the hidden being brought forth, apo bringing forth, making from. So apocalypse means not, you know, fire and brimstone, like we think of it, or zombie apocalypse or something. It means that which is revealed. So we talk about that book as the book of the revelation of Jesus, you see. Anyway, that's what you see here. And above them, in the 2 layers above, you see the 9 muses. I won't go into all that, but those are the ones that inspired Homer, in particular, not Cleo, Calliope, the muse of epic poetry. And so she's one of those. And you also see Apollo on the far right over here. And then at the very top, you see Zeus, King Zeus, the king of the gods. And next to him, to his right, is the goddess Mnemosyne. And Mnemosyne is the goddess of memory. And so the Greeks are telling us that the power of the muses is the combination of Zeus's power and memory together. In order to do great art, you have to know the past. Isn't that interesting? Well, at any rate, there's a scene in the Odyssey. I'm going to speak just about one little tiny shred of the Odyssey. As an example, where Odysseus and his sailors are captured by the Cyclops. I know it's a pretty famous story. As you know, they were in a cave with a great stone covering the opening, and the Cyclops was snacking on a few of the men every day before going out to tend his sheep. And the sailors naturally found this a rather rude behavior and thought little of the Cyclops for this eating of them. And so they knew they had to find a way out of this cave. They couldn't get out on their own because this great stone there was far too heavy for all of them together to move. They had to wait for the Cyclops himself to move the stone to get out. So, but they did escape by their wits. And the way it went was they offered the Cyclops wine that he never drank. And then he got drunk and they blinded him. They sharpened a long stick and they stuck it in his eye. He only has one eye, and blinded him. And then they waited for him to move the stone for him to take the flocks out the next day. And they attached themselves underneath the sheep as they walked out, you see. So the Cyclops would reach down and grab each of the sheep on the way out to be sure that it was a sheep and not an escaping sailor. But the sailor was underneath, you see, hanging on underneath. So he felt the sheep and he let him go. So all of them got free. Pretty cool story, huh? Well, as exciting as it is, the scene had a further meaning to the Greeks. It offered, as I was saying, the hearers a contrast between the Greek man and the Cyclops. That is, between the civilized man and the barbarian. And nobody ever confuses which one is the barbarian in the story. The Cyclops had only one eye. He lived alone on an island and with almost no community, even with other cyclops. And he lived in a cave, and he drank goat's milk, and he ate sheep, bones and all, uncooked, which is, of course, how he ate the sailors. And, of course, they weren't very impressed with that, were they? In contrast, the sailors had two eyes, which meant that they were better at seeing depth, figuratively and literally. They lived on an island too, these sailors, but they lived in community with other people. And what's more, they learned to build ships and to navigate the seas so that they were in community with other cultures as well. They cooked their meat. They didn't eat it raw. They differentiated between meat and gristle and bone and so on, and they only ate the meat. They drank wine, not goat's milk. And that making of wine, of course, requires all sorts of abilities like wisdom and patience, characteristics like wisdom and patience, and then abilities like knowing how to grow grapes. They had to have farming abilities. They had to be able to ferment the wine. They had to also be patient as they waited for it to be ready to be drunk. So in a sense, the Cyclops was the personification of immediate gratification. Immediate sight, immediate, you know, no depth, and undifferentiated activity like eating and drinking and so on. Didn't take anything to drink goat's milk, right? It came right out of the goat. So there are many more points of comparison. For example, because of their ability to understand how to make wine and to build ships that they were able to get out and subdue the Cyclops and escape, you see. But perhaps that's enough of a point to say that the two epics in their entirety had a definition of identity for the Greeks. It became a centering point for their civilization. Another example from the Greeks is this metope from the walls of the Parthenon. There are many stories told in the frieze metopes on the walls of the Parthenon. One in particular on the south side is this, a set of metopes. A metope is another kind of frieze sculpture, and that square right there is in the British Museum still, again. And it's probably about 4 or 5 feet across and 4 or 5 feet tall, something like that, to give you an idea of how big it is. And they were set in the upper part of the south wall of the Parthenon all the way down. Anyway, this was a story, this whole set of them, told the story of the battle between the Lapiths, an early Greek people, and the Centaurs. Centaurs, you know, are half horse and half man. And the story goes that the Centaurs were invited to the wedding of the Lapith king, and they drank too much wine, and they then attempted to rape all the Lapith women. And the Centaur leader himself actually tried to run off with the bride of the wedding. And so there was naturally an ensuing battle. They weren't very happy about all that. So there was a battle between them, and the Centaurs were defeated. But they were defeated with the help of Apollo, the god Apollo, and with the hero Theseus. Maybe you've heard of Theseus before. Theseus is the fellow who also figured out how to get out in and out of the maze on Crete, I think it was, and killed the Minotaur, if you remember. Well, anyway, again, this is more than just an adventure story. It was placed on the Parthenon for a particular reason. The temple of Athena was where what they were thinking of, and Athena is the goddess of wisdom. And it reminded everybody that the Greek identity was based on the overcoming of passions by reason. Do you see? Because the Centaurs represented the animal side of the human being as their half man, half horse. The fully human being is the one who conquers his animal nature to become fully civilized, you see. The victory of the humans represents more than just the idea of might makes right or just an adventure story to entertain people as they looked at the building. But this overcoming further defines our identity as human beings for the Greeks. They were convinced that they were communicating transcendent truths about human life, important enough to set in stone for forever. They were thinking they're telling you something that's the truth for all people at all times, you see. In the ancient world, following up on this, the Romans conquered the Greeks, but adopted much of their humanist thought and thus their definitions of human identity. We might think of the Greeks and Romans as rather uncivilized compared to our day. I mean, after all, we have at our fingertips all the plays of Shakespeare, all the music of Bach, all the back episodes of Tiger King. But we need to see these classical cultures against the backdrop of other pagan cultures of their day. And let's not forget that the Jewish culture of that ancient time, too, was very civilized comparatively. But the truly dramatic cultural change of the day came with Christianity. I'm going to go back to my outline here. I have an outline to show you that, like Dick said, I'm not just meandering. The Romans and the Jews didn't get along very well, it's true. They had a lot of differences. But the one thing they had in common was that they each defined human identity on the basis of the fulfillment of the law. If the Greeks were philosophers, then the Romans were lawyers. And the Pharisees, too, were law keepers, givers and keepers, right? What they had in common was virtue based on human volition. You had to earn your salvation yourself. You had to keep the law. Now, obviously, they didn't have the same laws. We know that the Jewish Old Testament law was supernaturally delivered. But on the question, the specific question of who has to keep the law, it's very clear. You do. Into this world came a Christian teaching that no one can fully keep the law, which was discouraging at first, but then the good news follows it up to say that someone has kept the law for you. The shift, this big shift, excuse me, from personal responsibility for keeping the law to the doctrine of imputed righteousness was a truly radical change in the identity of human beings. It undermined the entirety of human culture up to that point, and actually since then. And it motivated Christians by love and gratitude to keep the law. It's not that we don't keep the law anymore, but we do it without fear. We're not afraid any longer. We do it out of gratitude and love. Now, this identity becomes the centerpiece of the Western world after Rome falls in 476. Augustine's Confessions, written toward the end of the 4th century, offers a glimpse of this new pattern for identity. It seems a little bit like an epic, if you've read the Confessions, like the Odyssey or like the Aeneid. But it's not about a great man who's bringing justice to his kingdom or founding a new city like Aeneid. The Aeneas, it's about the spiritual journey of one person from childhood to adulthood and from unbelief to faith, but considered as important as any epic, or maybe more so. Augustine's autobiography, was open and transparent about his sins, his lust, his pride, his errors in judgment, and it depicted us, human beings, as significant in the eyes of God, reinforcing the Christian teaching that before God, there was no hierarchy of Jew, Greek, male, female, rich, poor, slave, free. Not that God despised hierarchies, by the way. I don't think that's true. He just despised the ones that we made for ourselves. After all, Jesus didn't say, the last shall be first, and the first shall be the same as everyone else. Borrowing on the tradition of the epic and the metaphor in an epic of the journey as a spiritual journey, the Christian culture crafts many works. Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, Beowulf, Dante's Divine Comedy, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, Spenser's Fairy Queen, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. All of these give you a protagonist and give a depiction of how he fights his own inner centaurs by way of this supernatural help. Usually embodied, this supernatural help is usually embodied in the personified by a woman. Virtuous woman. Boethius, for example, meets the woman philosophy. You know, in Consolation of Philosophy, he's condemned to death and he's in prison. And while he's in prison and bemoaning his fate, along comes the lady philosophy and consoles him. There's a wonderful picture, medieval picture, of the lady of Boethius down on his in his chair, and the woman philosophy coming in, and she's giving him a pair of wings. It's beautiful. I should have put it up here. So Boethius meets the woman philosophy. Dante is led by Lucia and by eventually Beatrice. Red Cross Knight in Fairy Queen is depends on Una early on. And the Pilgrim in the Pilgrim's Progress meets a lot of embodied virtues throughout that allegory. The identity of the person is made clear to the reader by the association. And we then root for Beowulf over Grendel and over Grendel's mother and the dragon. We recognize the value of avoiding the sins that Dante's character finds in the Inferno and the logic of the punishments that he sees there. And sometimes we laugh at the comic situations, the sometimes comic situations discussed on the pilgrimage to Canterbury. And all of these things reinforce the notion that the meaning of life is to be found in the identity that we have as souls. And the telos of our lives, that is, where we're going, is toward eternity. And that work, that sanctifying work toward eternity, is really what's happening in our lives. That's quite different than anything that had gone before. Well, this brings us to the modern world. From the legalization of the Christian faith in the Roman 4th century to the end of the Middle Ages, which is about 1,000 years, Christian definitions of human identity prevailed in the West. And when I say the West, by the way, I mean both Rome and Constantinople, not the split in the church, but the split between the Western Christendom and the Eastern mysticism, Hindus, Buddhists, Confucians, that sort of thing. With the Florentine Renaissance in the 1400s, the authority of the church had begun to be challenged by Greek and Roman definitions of human identity again. When people tell you about the Renaissance, and the word Renaissance means rebirth in French, right? Renaissance. They'll tell you that it's the Renaissance, the rebirth of culture. But don't you listen to them. You should know better. By the time the Florentine Renaissance begins, the Gothic cathedral had been standing for hundreds of years. In fact, Notre Dame, you know, that burned not too many years ago, was built in begun in 1163, and that means that by the time the Florentine Renaissance happened, it had been standing longer than the United States has been around. Just to keep it in perspective a little bit. So the Gothic cathedral, the Dante's Divine Comedy, one of the high points of the Middle Ages, and the third thing I always advertise is Thomas Aquinas' Summa. All of those things had happened in the 13th century or before, and as a result, when you get to the 1400s and somebody tells you that culture had been reborn, you must make sure they put in there classical culture, that is, Roman and Greek culture, may have been reborn, but not, certainly not culture in general. Okay, soapbox away. Anyway, at the time of the 1400s, there was the burgeoning Reformation too, right, and into the 1500s with Luther, but Huss was burned in 1415 or so, and so anyway, in the 14th, about the time that we're talking about, the Reformation was happening, but that was an attack, in a sense, a critique of the church from the right, and I'm talking mainly for this talk about the critique of the church happening from the Greeks or from the left, if you want to think of it that way. So in a sense, well, as much as the Reformation means in so many other ways, it's not really a part of the question that we're discussing today, so I'm going to leave that part out. The main influence from this pagan side, though, was to imagine man as, if not sinless, at least as the highest and most powerful in God's creation. This is not so much a departure from orthodoxy, but a shift in emphasis, I think. From man's spiritual journey in the medieval mindset, a spiritual journey in preparation for eternity, to man's physical life in this world in order to exercise dominion. The old Greek humanist teaching from Protagoras gains a new foothold in the 15th century. Man is the measure of all things. That pre-Socratic philosopher is the one who said that first, but it became very popular in Italy in the 1500s. And it inflates the identity of man, I think, while safely skirting the church's warnings about self-sufficiency or independence or autonomy. After all, we are to be God's stewards in his creation, right? That's right. But it can, and I think it did, lead to a kind of hubris, kind of pride. We are the pinnacle of the creation. It's time we acted like it, demand our rightful place. And this ambiguity led to a number of debates and confusions among many of the great geniuses that we find in the Renaissance at the time. Their doubts about authority and scripture and tradition and so on are well known. And it could be said that those confusions often came as a result, frankly, of the questions that they were asking about what it is to be a human being made in the image of God and to wrestle with this new idea from, or this revival of an idea from the Greeks. But it was not until the Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th centuries that the two sides draw swords and come to blows. By the end of the 18th century, rationalism and empiricism have joined forces. And I agree with Mike. I think he said earlier on that this is embodied in the person of Immanuel Kant. I think that's a fair statement to make. Autonomous human reason toward the beginning of the 19th century is enthroned above revelation as the highest authority for human identity. So in the middle of the 18th century, you have Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and he openly rejects the doctrine of original sin. And he claims that man is born good, but is limited by oppressions from cultural authorities like the church, the aristocracy, and the norms of his day. The revolutionaries that came 40 years later embraced this approach fully. Edmund Burke, you know, said Rousseau was the father of the French Revolution with this kind of idea. Well, the revolutionaries embraced this approach fully, and it sadly but inevitably led to this bloodbath that we call the French Revolution against not just the aristocrats of the day. They certainly didn't like them, and they beheaded Louis XVI and his wife Marie, but also against the church, because the church was another authority that was to be pushed aside. And anyone who sided with them were caught up in the bloodbath too. Diderot, the fellow that invented the encyclopedia, is said to have said, I won't rest until the last aristocrat is strangled by the entrails of the last bishop. Which I think puts him in the running for to be father of the cancel culture, don't you think? That's pretty good. Well, by the middle of the next century, 1800s, Karl Marx is writing Das Kapital. Now, most of us rightly think of Marx as reducing all things to economic classes and materialism, and that's right. But the reason for his focus on economics is interesting. And I think it's essential to our discussion about identity. Marx argued that all human beings needed to be able to be free to use their own labor to fulfill their own aims. He hoped to close the gap between labor needed to provide for oneself and one's family, what he called necessary labor, and with the gap between that and the labor that was in, every individual wants to be able to do for himself, for his own sort of self-expression. He argued that only those who have material wealth, that is capital, can be free to use their labor to fulfill their own selves. The proletariat were, by lack of their capital, not able to be free then, you see, since they're working for someone else. This is why he argued that the workers of the world should unite and shake off their chains and all of that, because he felt the disproportionate allotment of capital made it impossible and unjust for people to be able to fulfill themselves, and everybody should be able to fulfill himself. That's what Marx was thinking. And I hope you can see that you can trace that idea back to the idea of the Imago Dei, the image of God in man, that every individual was significant in and of himself, and that he should be free to be able to follow the course, the path of freedom that God has made for him. But it's just holding on to an old Christian idea, but excluding God from the equation, if you can see that. And that's what's going on, I think, in the Enlightenment in general. It wasn't just because it was no fun to be poor. It wasn't. But he argued that this disproportional allotment of capital was unjust, you see, and the poor then had to use their labors to fulfill the interests of their employers and not themselves. So underneath this purely materialistic assumption that we associate with Marx was a definition of human identity that could be traced, I think, back to Rousseau. Man's inner desires are inherently good, and if not allowed his freedom because he's because of a flawed economic system, then a man is not able to achieve happiness, and it's unjust to deny any man that freedom. Now, this approach, stemming as it does, I think, from Rousseau, rejects the Christian doctrine of man as a sinner from birth and in need of an external savior, and it helps explain some of the 20th century's most influential ideas. After seeing the Russian Revolution fail to bring about utopia in Eastern Europe and in Russia, the Western communists, between the two wars, decided to expand their vision to win the culture by way of their economic vision, and they assumed that personal satisfaction in life was the goal of life still, like Marx did, and that self-expression is the way to satisfaction, to happiness. But they weren't going to win the day until they could win the culture. That was their conclusion. And we're talking about people, you probably have heard the names before, the Italian Gramsci and the Frankfurt School, Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno and people like that. This was during the 20s, late 20s, early 30s, between the two wars in Europe, in Germany and Italy. It was assumed that the culture served as a sea anchor resisting an economic revolution. And so it needed to be changed before the Marxian revolution could come about, they thought. The vision of society's moral codes had to be changed in people's minds. Instead of being seen as helps to keep the honest, virtuous man in line with a picture of good civilized behavior, These morals had to be seen as oppressive legalisms that were only being used to keep people enslaved, you see. And that once you change that, then anybody that calls for any kind of moral stand becomes oppressive. Just a short digression about the definition of freedom. Freedom is a word that needs to be defined, and it's like change, it is a meaningless idea unless it's associated with some object. Are you trying to be freed to do something, or are you trying to be freed from something? Professor Tolkien refused to deny that his critics were wrong when they said that his Middle Earth stories were escapist. He said something like that it all depended on what one was escaping from. To a man in prison, escape is a good thing. And that's how he saw his stories, that we were imprisoned in a mindset that his stories would break us free from. And so he wasn't going to deny that it was escapist, only that it was misunderstood. But in the same way, freedom to do something is the ability to do the right thing, to do the good. A free man has no restrictions on doing the right thing. Of course, one must have a set of beliefs that he knows are right before he starts to talk about freedom per se. But once in hand, those ethical judgments, anything that keeps one from doing the good is, by definition, oppressive and enslaving. Now, if the Christian identity is the true one, and we think it is, then the thing keeping us from doing the good, the greatest thing keeping us from doing the good, is our sin nature. It's impossible as fallen human beings to perfectly keep the law and to do good in all circumstances so as to earn salvation. If it were possible, we wouldn't need to be saved, you see. Now, freedom from, though, means the exclusion of anything that would hinder one from following his own will wherever it leads. It means freedom from anything that hinders self-expression, you see. The assumption is that self-expression, again, is the satisfaction in life. And when combined with the idea that man is basically good, this sets our moral compass against anything that causes us to have our wills crossed. But it assumes autonomy. It assumes autonomy. Do you hear that? Autonomy, right? What does that mean? Auto means self, and nomi, nom, is law. So autonomy, autonomy, is a law to myself. I am my own law. And you can see that our beliefs about identity lead necessarily to one or the other of these definitions of freedom. If we hold that man is basically good, then anything that opposes self-expression would be considered inherently evil. But if, on the other hand, if evil is intrinsic to man, as the Christian argues, then the idea of freedom from might lead us into slavery rather than out of it. Because, as Lewis beautifully says in Abolition of Man, we become slaves to our own appetites. And thus, we would be doomed at the same time that we thought we were pursuing our happiness. Do you see that? Jesus said that anyone who sins is a slave to sin in John 8. And Paul wrote, our old self was crucified with him so that the body ruled by sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves to sin. That's what we're after. That's from Romans 6. The present iteration of this identity, this Rousseauian identity, if you want to call it that, goes even further, I think, today. It leaves the realm of the psychological identity of the individual that you find in Philip Reif in the 60s and now in Carl Truman in this therapeutic individualized mindset, and it shifts into what I'm thinking is a sociological identity for human beings. Marx thought of people in economic classes, but now we think of people by way of other classes than economic. We think of them in political classes, or gender, or sexual orientation, ethnicity, nationality. Even civilizations are pitted against each other. The Marxian revolution, intended to set the individual free to pursue happiness through self-expression, accomplishes its goal by disrupting the present orders of society. And this is done by pitting classes of people against one another. Not only rich against poor, but man against woman, black against white, America versus other countries, left versus right, gay versus straight, Western versus any other civilization, Christian versus other religions. This is done not so much because those encouraging the divisions are interested in the injustices that they see, let's just say some of them don't, but the ones that are really at the bottom of these things, I argue, are not interested in those injustices. They're more interested in the revolution. I remember hearing, do you remember the Weathermen back in the 60s? Some of you are old enough to remember the Weathermen, SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society. I remember hearing one of their people argue that, say this quote, it really sort of explains what I'm talking about. He said, remember, the issue is never the issue is the revolution. Part of the solution to these seemingly impossible problems would be a return to proper understanding of human identity, I think. You're far more than a member of a class, and the evil in the world can't be stamped out by correcting broken systems, as the evil comes from the very heart of every human being suggesting the new systems. Does this mean that we turn a blind eye to oppression, manipulation, power grabbing, lying, bigotry that we see around us all the time? Heck no! Well, that's not what I said. I said, of course not. We're called to stand against the effects of the fall wherever they may appear. But, as Dr. Schaefer said many times, it's not enough that we do God's work. We have to do God's work in God's way. And we're in danger today of prejudging one another by way of class or ethnicity or sexual attraction, and then finding their offenses so repulsive we see no reason to forgive them. Very dangerous place to be. Always remember the parable that Jesus told about the man who was forgiven 10,000 talents and then didn't forgive his brother. It's very, very dark. Go back and read that. The ending of it is very, very dark. So, in summary, the Western world has seen three basic definitions of human identity in the last 2,500 years. Man can be understood as a pagan before the pantheon of the gods, civilized by their laws and called to keep them. He can be seen, secondly, as a crucified self, living a redeemed life by the grace of God, sacrifice on our behalf. Or he can be seen as an autonomous self, that sets his own course and is his own law. The first identity defined the good life as keeping the laws of the gods, or in the case of the Jews, keeping the laws of God himself. The second identity recognizes the impossibility of keeping the law and embraced the perfect gift of imputed righteousness that God provided. The third identity is an act, well, in an act of breathtaking ego, I think, asserts that the individual is a law unto himself and defines as evil anything that limits that autonomy. In the end, I argue that the third way is really nothing but the first way, without the pantheon of gods. The classical gods of the Greeks and others were nothing but men and women raised to the level of, quote, bigger than life. Their flaws and sins were evident, expressing pride, jealousy, anger, sloth, wrath, greed, sexual promiscuity. Those were the gods. Today, we simply make ourselves the gods. Treat me like you would treat Zeus, we think. I'm only doing what I like, and I shouldn't be restricted by any authority that would keep me from full self-expression. Do you see the ego in that? Scary. Today, this idea has become so pervasive and so persuasive that some reject not only moral laws, now we even make our own bodies our enemies and attempt to change them with chemicals and surgery, and all in an attempt to fit our self-identity. We have gone from claiming the church oppresses us to saying that reality itself oppresses us. So not only should the church be kept from teaching anything we deem oppressive, but bakers have to help us celebrate our assertions, and doctors have to do gender reassignment surgery, and the world has to basically revolve around me. We'll brook no arguments against these things. This is not a debate any longer for many people. We insist because the expression of the new self is now sacrosanct, there you are, and anyone or anything that stands in the way is by definition anti-human. You're against us. And hatred and evil like that simply doesn't deserve to be heard in a civilized society. Thus we find we can imagine as reasonable what a generation ago would have thought unthinkable. Embracing arguments against the freedom of speech, for example. There are certain things that shouldn't be allowed to be said. Silencing the oppression seems inherently virtuous to the person who thinks this way. When we have decided what is good and the opposition is not just mistaken but evil, what debate can you have? We demonize one another. Mind you, this happens on both sides of the debate. There's demonization going on both sides. It's easy to think that any claim to transcendent truth, such as Nietzsche argued, is merely a play for power and influence, and by necessity will restrict the free expression of some people. Nietzsche, of course, also realized that embracing this idea would lead to the necessity of the law of the jungle, and said so. And only the strongest and most ruthless of us will survive. So it seems that there's a direct line then between a misunderstanding of identity and a return to barbarism. But it's the truth that'll set us free. So we have a divided civilization. In many ways, our civilization has given up on the Christian definition of human identity. Oddly enough, our modern world is still haunted by biblical notions of virtue and freedom. We think that we should be standing up for things like righteousness and liberty, but without God's definitions, each of these words becomes perverted. Here's another great word. Do you know what perverted means? Vers versa is to be twisted. So perversa is to be bent out of shape. Taking something that's in the right shape and twisting it out of shape. That's what perverse means. Virtue, unmoored from God's character, is redefined to our human standards instead, yet is pursued with the zeal worthy of the Pharisees. And freedom, unmoored from God's law, redefines liberty as license and autonomy. The British statesman Edmund Burke, that I mentioned a little while ago, in the late 18th century, argued extensively against Rousseau's Enlightenment French Revolution mindset, and in doing so, described two ways of thinking that shape the way we address the culture today. These two view, one is called the idyllic imagination, I-D-Y-L-L-I-C, idyllic imagination, and the other is called the moral imagination. Now, these two views differ in a lot of different ways, and I could point you to Burke and to Russell Kirk and some other people, T.S. Eliot, who have done a really good job of defining these things. But for our purposes today, I want to focus on one aspect in particular, the way each of these two views see human identity with regard to evil, to the source of evil. Both sides agree that there is evil in the world. It's hard to ignore. I think Chesterton said that that evil in the world, or the doctrine of original sin, is the only doctrine that you can prove by just walking out into the world. It's just everywhere you look. Nobody disagrees that there's evil in the world. Where they disagree is that they hold differing opinions about where it comes from. And prognosis dictates treatment. The idyllic imagination identifies the individual as having been born good. It's a kind of blank slate. And the undeniable evil of the world can best be explained as wrong-headed institutions. For example, the government or the church or social norms and so on. The moral imagination, on the other hand, holds that evil in the world comes from the heart of every individual. That is, that man is basically fallen, and the line between good and evil falls between the two halves of every human heart, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn has said. You can see how an identity of man as basically good could lead to a belief that institutions are to blame for the evils of the world. Can you see that? There are two good reasons. First, you can't deny evils themselves. They're there, undeniably. But if we reject the interior source of evil, there's nothing left but the external ones. But second, and more insidiously, if we can locate the evil in the institutions, there's a hope that we can eliminate it. We can find a solution to it, you see? We can have some control over its propagation. In this way, we're not left to despair. This idyllic imagination is a very optimistic view of the world. Let's pool our strengths, we say. Let's pool our funds and our technologies and meet this challenge head on. We can do it. Very optimistic. The premise of the moral imagination, that evil is interior, requires that we accept that the solution for the problem of evil is actually beyond our control. It requires that we accept everything outside of our ability to change it. You remember Paul saying, "Who will save me from this body of sin and death? I can't save myself. What I do, I don't want to do. What I don't want to do, I do. How can I ever get out of this?" In fact, since the definition of sin is self-centered, any act that I do to try and save myself is an example of the very sin that I'm trying to get out of. Do you see that? It's inherently contradictory. So the moral imagination seems to condemn us to living without hope of ever overcoming evil. No, we think, the unregenerate thought. No, we think. There must be a way we haven't tried yet. Maybe if we make a rule that no one can ever be racist, that'll work, right? Or we fine pastors for telling us men can't be women. That'll do it. The thought of living without hope of fixing the problem of evil is so horrible that it would be better to press on even if our solutions don't work. At least we're doing something. And so the idyllic imagination, thinking of itself as positively virtuous, is the default position for us today. As Christianity, the tide of Christianity declines, diminishes. And this way of thinking calls us to a never-ending sense of progress as it continues to seek out ways to fix the institutions. But embracing this optimism, this idyllic imagination, without realizing it, dooms us to failure. The idyllic imagination finds itself increasingly opposed to anyone who disagrees about the evils of the institutions in question. Opponents, frankly, aren't to be reasoned with. You don't reason with evil. The virtue of the proposed change should be self-evident, we think. When the laws are broken, fines should escalate into imprisonment. As a last resort, execution. All done with a sort of religious fervor. Have you noticed that lately? It's almost like there's another religion in the air that has its own priesthood and its own set of rules. Does it seem impossible? This spirit that wants to eliminate anybody that stands in the way? I hope I'm wrong. But John 16:2 says, Jesus says, "The time is coming when anyone who kills you will think he's offering a service to God." What I'm saying is that once I believe that I'm addressing evil by opposing institutions, I can become quite self-righteous and believe with all my heart that I'm being virtuous, standing against those who increasingly appear to me as merely thugs and bigots deserving of no quarter. I'm on the right side of history, we hear. But it may be instead we're just on the wrong side of identity. So you see, all men, even the most horrible of us, want to address evil when we see it. All men long for a kind of utopia. We just disagree about human identity. Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? Our decision about human identity leads us to the question of where evil resides. And that leads us to what we ought to do about it, giving us a sense of a moral compass. But a man-made utopia doesn't exist. You know, the word utopia, spelt utopia, means nowhere. There's a long-going debate about Thomas More's book, Utopia, wondering if he meant that he was in favor of it or against it. But he spelt it with a U, not an E-U. E-utopia means good place. But utopia means no place. And whether he was doing it tongue-in-cheek or not, we don't know. Interestingly enough, both sides believe in education, but both sides, the idyllic and the moral imagination, are going to educate differently. Education for the idyllic imagination will inevitably be focused on the future. To be significant, the student has to learn to discern where there are injustices, inequalities, oppressions, anything that reveals the evils of our institutions that want putting right. And so it shouldn't surprise us that much of our university education today is indoctrination, frankly, in how to see the world through the lenses of these various ideologies of feminism, communism, whatever, rationalism, postmodernism. But education for the moral imagination will be focused on the past, the wisdom of our ancestors. The moral imagination says we can only make tomorrow better by knowing, respecting, and applying the wisdom of our ancestors, the wisdom that is the same for all people at all times. And they think of it, the moral imagination thinks of that kind of past wisdom as a way of keeping the fifth commandment. You know the fifth commandment, right? Honor your parents, honor your mother and father. So not just your biological mother and father, but your cultural or intellectual mothers and fathers. Now, it may seem, this is an important point, it may seem like I'm quietly making a case for a political party, but I would really like you to hear me clearly, and believe me when I say I am not. Both political parties today, I think, are infested with this idyllic imagination. Both have folks that are deeply invested in the notion that simply electing the right people and making the right laws will fix all of our problems, that the problem is external, extrinsic, you see? But these will never bring about the ends that they want. Samuel Johnson said, quote, "Men are evidently so corrupt that all the laws of heaven and earth are inefficient to restrain them from their crimes." Isn't that great? The moral imagination assumes that the source of evil is in the heart of each of us, an assumption that leads to a certainty that there will always be suffering, injustice, inequality of outcome, and variation of wealth and power in our fallen world. This doesn't mean that the moral imagination is indifferent to the evils found in the institutions of the world. But it recognizes that even if we were able to sniff out and correct every injustice in those institutions, we would still not have touched the source of those problems, the human heart. And any new system we substituted would have its own unintended consequences. We must stand against the effects of the fall and care for our neighbors, no doubt about that. The idyllic imagination critiques the moral imagination in a way that I think has some merit. And that is that we can't live without hope of being able to stand against the effects of the fall, stand against evil. And we are called by the Christian mindset to participate in God's redemption of this creation. So we have no mandate to ignore or tolerate evil, ever. But the good news is that the evil has been overcome, not through anything that we've done. That's the difference. Of course, this is a bit hard on our egos. We want to be the superheroes in the story. And it's a little deflating, frankly, to find out that our role in this cosmic drama is to play Lois Lane to another Superman. But that's our identity. We are the bride. So which is right? The idyllic mind that thinks it's so virtuous by fixing its mind on the future and doing whatever is necessary to adjust the institutions? The moral mind that thinks it's being virtuous by thanking God for dying in our place and reconciling ourselves to Him? Each side thinks the other is wasting its time, barking up the wrong tree. The idyllic mind can't understand why you don't use every power you've got to address the problems of our present situation. We need to tackle poverty, hunger, oppression, racism, government overreach, all of those things. The moral mind, on the other hand, can't understand why you're not doing everything you can to become holy. We need to overcome our lusts for sex and power and greed and self-centeredness and, most of all, pride. But we can't hear each other. The idyllic mind sees its opponents as little more than outdated moralists trying to hang on to a kind of pathetic past. Their arguments sound to them, the moral argument sounds to the idyllic mind as outdated morals like don't play cards and don't go to R-rated movies or something, you know? The moral imagination sees its opponents as little more than panic-stricken utopians, trying to address evil without any kind of introspection. Their arguments sound like, the sky is falling, help, you know, do something. Well, how can you just sit there and do nothing? So how do we go about addressing that problem? I think identity is the way to do it. And I'll close with this. At the risk of sounding super spiritual, we continue to faithfully proclaim the good news that our identity is hidden in Christ. That's what we do. That we are, as Paul said, crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. We die to the definitions of both diagnosis and cure of all the evils of the world. And we learn to discern and depend on the Spirit to let us know when to speak and when to shut up. How to take up arms, when to take up arms, and when to heal the sick. When to work and when to pray. And actually how close those two things are. And remember the wisdom that we should try our best in this life not to make enemies. Because you know, if you make enemies, you've got to love them. I want to close with a quote. It's a lengthy quote, but it is worth every syllable. And I'm not going to just read it to you. I'm going to read it to you, but I'm going to put it up here, too, so you can see it. And at the end of it, the reference is there in case you want to look it up for yourself and see it later. This is from then-Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict XVI. And it goes like this. I think, I saw this just this morning, and I thought, this is so good, I've got to include it. It is a thoroughly Christian impulse to combat suffering and injustice in the world. But to imagine that men can construct a world without them by means of social reform and the desire to do so here and now is an error. A deep misunderstanding of human nature, and by that I would say human identity. For suffering does not come into the world solely because of the inequality of possessions and power. Nor is it just a burden from which men should free themselves. Anyone who wishes to do that must escape into the distorted world of narcotics in order to thus destroy himself. It is only by enduring himself, by freeing himself through suffering, from the tyranny of egoism, that man finds himself, that he finds his truth, his joy, his happiness. The measure of one's capacity for happiness depends on the measure of the premiums one has paid, on the measure of one's readiness to accept the full passion of being human. The crisis of our age is made very real by the fact that we would like to flee from it, that people mislead us into thinking that one can be human without overcoming oneself, without the suffering of renunciation and the hardship of self-control. Those people mislead us by claiming that there is no need for the difficulty of remaining true to what one has undertaken and the patient endurance of the tension between what one ought to be and what one actually is. An individual who has been freed from all effort and led into the fool's paradise of his dreams loses what is most essential, himself. I put that in bold myself. There is, in fact, no other way in which one can be saved than by the cross. All offers that promise a less costly way will founder, will prove to be false. The hope of Christianity, the outlook of faith, ultimately rests quite simply on the fact that faith tells the truth. The outlook of faith is the outlook of the truth that may be obscured, trampled on, but can never perish.